Hello, this is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Sunday, July the 12th, 2020, and this is one more of my ongoing series of podcasts. And as you know, an election is coming up in the United States in November for president and other representatives. And today I have the great pleasure of speaking with and introducing to you Dr. Valerie McCray, PhD from the University of Michigan, who most interestingly is running as an independent candidate for president of the United States. Yes, you heard right. An independent candidate for president of the United States. I certainly wish there were more like her, but we're gonna hear from her today. How are you today, Dr. McCray?
I am just fantastic. I got to speak to you for a few minutes earlier, and you actually gave me some words of inspiration. So I'm actually better than what I was a few minutes ago before you called. So it's a perfect day today.
Well, I've got to tell you that I have been involved in supporting independent candidates for many years. I've been one myself, actually, on multiple occasions. And my view of this is that independent candidates are the only chance of saving the democratic process in North America from these political parties, which I think have really gotten out of hand. What are your views on that?
You know, I think my views on that is just exactly the same as you said, but actually with even more of an urgency. I think what really gave me some energy is when you said that this is the beginning of the age of the independent candidate. I believe it's going to actually happen faster than what we think, because it needs to happen faster than what we think it could happen. Right now with the party alliances, we're sort of in danger zone, and we've been in danger zone for a while, but absolutely, we can see now what happens if you align strictly with party and not based on some sort of principle that's outside of party.
Yeah, I think that's right. And just drawing listeners' attention to your Twitter feed, which is twitter.com, Dr. V. McCray, M-C-C-R-A-Y, 2020. Again, that's twitter.com, Dr. V, M-C-C-R-A-Y, 2020. You have this wonderful tweet, July the 7th, where you say, not against Democrats, not against Republicans. Fact is, there's quite a bit of overlap and crossing over. I want to bridge that divide, not blow up the bridge. We have too much work to do to continue this partisan craziness. That's why I'm running independent. And God, I don't think it could be better said. That's why we need lots of independent candidates. But I wonder, could you describe some of the problems of this toxic partisan politics?
You know, we've gotten so, you know, the most outstanding thing about the current president is that the toxicity has like sort of come to the top. It's gotten to the point where you've watched candidates, you've watched senators, you've watched people hold a certain ground all their life, and you see this switch in their verbiage that is opposite of what they would have said before, based on the fact that they're trying to stay within the direction of the party and not the direction of what is the right thing to do. You know, we watched the Mueller investigation. We watched all these things, and things were decided based on, you know, whether or not to use witnesses or not. And all these things were decided based on party alliance and not based on any type of what do we stand for? What is right? What do we need to look at? What do we need to move forward? It wasn't based on anything other than party alliance. And so we had these divisions down party lines with a few senators here and there that voted against their party. And they really paid the price for that. You know, and that's really, it's terrible that if you vote your own conscience, that you can lose support of your political party, or there's these attacks, or you have a president that says that I'm not going to support you in your campaign now since you're against this or against that. So it's gotten dangerous because people are afraid now to even speak up or be for what they believe in and not the party. I hope I didn't I hope I wasn't too long-winded on that, but
exactly right. I think you got it upside down, diagonally, and sideways. And, you know, in another one of your tweets on July 7th, in part you say it's the two-party system that is destroying this country. I'm not running against the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I'm running for Americans. And, you know, one sort of observation I would have is that I would think that the average voter would imagine that his local congressman has his interests, the voter's interests at heart. And I think you and I would both agree that that's often not the case because of the party system.
Absolutely. And we don't know the financial connections as well. It's very interesting how that works. You know, I actually did something, and it wasn't exactly because I was just curious. This was based on a need as well. I actually drove Lyft for about 4 months, and I just used that actually while I was driving Lyft. I said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead. Nothing's going to stop me. I'm going to actually campaign while I'm driving Lyft. Now, you're not supposed to get into these political conversations while you're driving Lyft, but, of course, nobody recognized me in that capacity. And so I would say, hey, you know, do you want to keep your president? You know, or what do you want for your next president? Or do you just want to just keep the one you've got? And that question was sort of very benign, but it would get these answers that were pretty consistent, or some of them were. I would get very, I think, heartfelt answers. And most people that I came across didn't want either. They want, I don't want this guy, but I'm not necessarily great on this guy. I'm just really independent. I was running across a lot of independent people, and I didn't even realize when I first started that driving Lyft journey just how many people were there that were independent. And I think that's the majority of Americans are. They feel independent, but they feel at the last minute being pulled into this lesser of two evils type way of thinking.
I think that that's right. I mean, I think that largely they are independent who are forced in to a party system that requires for them to participate in the political process, for them to be a member of a political party and behave in that way.
Exactly.
And, you know, I mean, they're literally, you know, I think that this, and this is, by the way, to be clear, you know, I live in Canada. This is every bit as bad in Canada as it is in the United States, every bit as bad. So this is not a criticism of any one country, but it is a very strong criticism of political parties in general. You know, it's fascinating that, you know, these political parties, I think you would agree, I mean, we'll keep it America-based, Democrat versus Republican for this conversation, completely dominate the political process, yet there's no mention of a political party in the Constitution. Am I right on that?
You're absolutely right on that. And not to mention the fact that in the United States, the political parties, what they stand for, have flipped. The Democratic Party isn't what it was 100 years ago. The Republican Party is, you can't recognize it from the party of Lincoln back in the day. You can't even recognize it for that. Their philosophies have flipped. The candidates, they change allegiances and change parties at whim. And so now it's like, what is a Democrat? Can somebody tell me what a Democrat is versus what a Republican is? Can you just explain it to me? And I don't know if anyone can these days. There's certain, I feel like Republicans are, you know, these staunch people that have a set of ideas and they stick with it, and they're very fiscally, they want to be fiscally responsible. I see Democrats are more inclusive and they want to be socially responsible. other than that, I'm not seeing big, huge differences when you're talking about most of the people down the middle, most of the people. I don't even think people can define themselves. Oh, yeah, I'm a Republican. But if you were to ask them, okay, well, what do you stand for that Democrats don't? There might be a few issues that they might side with, but not necessarily. You know, it's really interesting. I know plenty of Republicans that that are like, oh, yeah, I'm Republican, but, hey, don't be trying to legislate my body with this whole abortion issue. I hear Democrats, you know, speak a certain way, and then they're like, yeah, but, you know, but they sound very conservative in other ways. I think that the parties, the definitions of the parties are, they don't mean anything. So it's more who your daddy voted for. You know, it's more of a, I don't know, a club that, you know.
Just I think that's exactly what it is. I think these things have become clubs to benefit their, you know, their members. And I think we see this. I'm not saying we don't see this with the Republican Party, but I think we see this very, very specifically and clearly with the Democratic National Committee nominating process, you know, for their nominating candidate for president, which seems to me to be, you know, largely it's this person's turn or that person's turn. But, you know, it seems to me, and I'm interested whether you agree with this, that to think of yourself as a Republican or a Democrat in this age is really to think of yourself as a person who wants to use labels rather than reason to analyze your political position. Do you think there's some truth to that?
I think it's not only some truth to that. Now it's sort of almost like a visceral, like almost a physical reaction for me to even think about wearing a label as far as Democrat or Republican. And I used to wear that label, that Democratic label. And it's something about once you get off the label or you take the label off, it's like you realize that those were sort of shackles in some sort of way. And it's like, no, the thought of getting back under that type of straitjacket, I can't even fathom it again now. You know, even if sometimes I'll throw something out there, okay, Joe Biden, maybe you need to pick me for vice president, but know this, I'm not a Democrat. I would still be an independent vice president. I'm not into the political party thing. I'm into this is what we need right now. And I forget your question, so to speak, but I just know I had this sort of reaction about the label. It's like, no, I don't want the label. I don't want that right now. I don't want that. I don't think I can ever go back to being under one label or the other.
Yeah. You know, about a year ago, you did a podcast that I listened to at great interest. And at that time, if I'm not mistaken, you were seeking the Democratic nomination for the presidency. Have I got that right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I loved your podcast. I thought, you know, wow. I mean, this is a seriously good candidate. Okay. But the thing I loved best about the podcast was where the interviewer, he said, no, you're an independent. Do you remember that?
I remember that was a very pivotal moment, actually.
I thought so, too. Mm-hmm. I thought so, too. And I wasn't sure. Well, of course, I'd had some contact with you by the point I'd heard this previous podcast. But if I hadn't had the contact, I couldn't tell whether you were going to dig in your heels as a Democrat or free yourself for the opportunities of being an independent. And when did you decide to free yourself to become an independent?
You know what? Not too far after that. I think even when I went into that interview, I was still trying to make myself fit into this Democratic thing. And I was noticing that I was veering off and I just did not want to have the same. I just didn't agree with all the talking points. And just hearing myself stumble while I was trying to articulate what I was doing without offending this Democratic Party, because after all, I'm saying I'm a Democrat, but I'm not really saying what you're saying. And trying to make sure I walked that thin line, I was like, I was sort of exhausted by the time I got to that interview of trying to fit into that poll. And so when he said that, it was like, you know what, you're kind of right. And then I met with my campaign team about a week or so later and said, you know what, let's just run independent, because this is not falling, for one, it's not falling together as a Democratic Party. I'm not really being pushed or supported by the Democratic Party. Why am I out here waving this flag of Democrat when nothing I'm saying is that in line with what they're saying? Why am I doing that when philosophically I'm just me? And everyone in my living room that particular day said, they paused for a second and then they just thought for a minute and they got quiet and said, okay, let's go with it. I didn't get one pushback, not one pushback. And I was asking for pushback. Give me pushback. And there was no one in the room. And I have a room full of opinionated people. We really get into the nitty gritty of every thing we talk about, and nobody pushed back. I think we all felt a sigh of relief, like, okay, now we're lined up with who we really are and not trying to fit in with this Democratic machine that wasn't really accepting us anyway, by the way. So I have to be very honest about that as well.
Well, that's very good. Now, you say that you were sort of, by running as an independent, you were independent, you freed yourself to be who you are. Perhaps we could get into a little bit about who you are. What do you do? Where did you originally get the idea to become politically active? And how did your career sort of lead you into this?
You know, I work, and I still do, I'm a psychologist, so I work in trauma, which means that I do PTSD evaluations for the military day in and day out. I work in prisons when I'm not doing that. I'm working with kids that are incarcerated. I am the consulting psychologist here for the Stop the Violence movement. And, of course, I have a private practice of people that are traumatized as well. With this being said, since I travel a lot with my psychology work, because of military bases that are across the country, I'm also, oftentimes sent to go do an evaluation on someone in a different state. Then I work in prisons that are like in Georgia and Indianapolis or whatever, but they're always out in these outskirts, these little small towns. So you get an idea of how the rural areas, the all-white rural areas, think as well, and sort of their problems that they're having, because they have these prisons in their community, mainly because, you know, a lot of their factories or industries are closed down in these small towns. So they're dying small towns that have picked up prisons as their income source, which is problematic. But as I see all these different trends, these small towns closed down, when we see the people inside the prisons, and not all of them need to be there, and you talk to the people coming back that have been in these wars and how they have fought in wars that mean practically nothing now, but they lost their mental capacities and they've lost their sense of well-being forever based on wars that are either still continuing or that have ended. And, you know, we might be working side by side but the very people that they thought were their enemies at the time. And it's just, what for? What was that all about? But the aftermath of trauma has led me to think, you know, this is not, I can't fix this one person at a time. And I liken this to that village doctor, right? So you've got a village doctor that can go from hut to hut to hut, and they're trying to figure out, why is it all this diarrhea and this fever and this you know, these things going on, these belly aches going on from house to house to house. So I can continue to treat each belly ache one at a time, or I can go to the well and treat the daggone well that's making the people sick in the first place. So that's how I feel about it. It's like I need to go to the well, and that well is Washington, D.C., because a lot of the things that are happening has more to do with the poison in the well than there is about what the people are doing in their communities. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes total sense, and I can see a connection between working with trauma professionally, and certainly I think the party system in the United States has inflicted tremendous trauma on individual Americans and their psyche, particularly over the last few years.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the party system is so disconnected from what's going on in the day-to-day lives of people. I think the whole political process is too disconnected from what's going on. So what happens is that in a political year, people are running and they run out and they run these polls to try to figure out what is the thing that's bothering people right now. What should I put on there? Is it health care? All right, I'll run with health care. Do I need to run with justice reform? And do I need to run with this? And it feels like these are people trying to just figure out what will appeal to the American people. Whereas me, I'm down here living with folks. I mean, I'm talking to them every day as part of their therapy or as part of trying to get programs together or that sort of thing. You don't have to ask me what's going on. I'm right here. I'm right here in the midst of it. So most of my family struggles with that poverty line. You know, so I'm very, very aware of what those struggles are, what a credit score means. I'm very, to your survival, I'm very aware of all of those things, of what it takes to live. And there's a lot of traumatic events that happen just living day to day that the political environment just don't realize. So they're so busy doing their party thing without realizing what's happening down with the people themselves. So,
is it your belief that the people you talk to as a Lyft driver in your personal life, in your professional life, in your role as running for a president, is it your perception that people feel largely disconnected from the political process, their vote doesn't matter?
They absolutely feel like their vote doesn't matter. They feel like they're being, again, pushed between a lesser of two evils type thing. That, again, I'm not saying that Biden is evil or Trump is evil. I'm not getting into that. But what I'm saying is that they keep being pushed into these lanes, like chattel, like either you go here or you go there. And people, that's turning people off. And so they feel like, well, it doesn't matter really what I think. I hear that all the time. And so a lot of people are disenfranchised totally by the system.
That's an amazing thing, because in most of the world, I think people equate the notion of democracy with having a right to vote. Personally, I have trouble seeing it that way, because I think that democracy may include a right to vote, but it certainly includes a right to vote for candidates that have a potential to represent you in some way, wouldn't you think?
You would think. And I don't think we're getting that. I don't think you're getting that, because the people that represent them might not have the money gets thrown behind the people who are most likely to win and that will be able to support the ideas of, you know, whatever the corporation is, whatever those things are. So it feels like our political system is more corporately ran, not necessarily based on the people themselves.
Well, I can't remember the name of it, but Citizens United, right? Doesn't the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Citizens United reinforce that? That, if I'm understanding, that corporations are people for the purposes of making political contributions. Have I got that right?
Yeah, the Citizens United thing, it really has really turned the tide as far as taking over the whole political system. And even you've got the PACs that were in conjunction with, but separately than the other streams of money, so that a PAC might not give directly to a candidate, but they might run, or Citizens United or whatever, they might run these ads for that particular party or against the other party. It's just very interesting how all that works, but there's a lot of money being spent, a lot of money using these political campaigns. They go through millions and millions and millions of dollars based on these donations to these Citizens United or these PACs that it's beyond anything that you could ever imagine. So, yes, there's one, the voters get their vote, and I'm not making light of that at all. People need to go ahead and vote. Whatever this is, vote. While we figure out how to fix it, people still need to vote. I think people are also turned off by the whole Electoral College thing here in the United States. They don't understand it. The premise that how it started was kind of shaky from the get-go, but it has its merits. But those things make people feel disenfranchised as well.
Or to put it simply, the idea that the popular vote would not carry the election.
Right. Yeah. And I think that might be feeding into my vote doesn't matter anyway, feeding into that conversation as well. Yeah. The Electoral College, it's set up to sort of balance. It wasn't set up for this reason totally, but it does sort of balance the power of the different states. So New York, for example, doesn't have the power to sort of override all the other.
So New York and California can't run the country.
Exactly.
Because of the larger populations. I mean, I think that I do agree that there's a certain logic to that.
But
all these things are sort of double-edged swords, aren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's a way to fix that where it doesn't align so much with, there's a way to fix that Electoral College situation, the delegates, that whole delegate thing without totally doing away with the Electoral College. We do something here called the winner takes all in a lot of the states, and it's not a part of our Constitution, but on voter ID, sorry, my phone fell, but on the night you're casting your votes, you can see where in some states, if you get some of the delegates, if you get most of the delegates, you get all of the delegates. So then you've got candidates that pinpoint certain states so that the way the delegates fall, even if they lose the popular vote, they win the election. If we got rid of the winner takes all aspect of that, and it's not in our Constitution, two states don't do that. If we got rid of that, then the popular vote and the actual election vote would actually coincide, would actually come together really nicely.
Well, I would think it would be particularly challenging or add to the challenge of what you're doing, once we get the overlay that, if I'm understanding you correctly, the different states have different rules for how to run their
democracy.
Absolutely. Yeah, so not only do you have to figure out how to run a campaign, but presumably you need to think strategically about the voting rules in the particular state, right?
In every state. As an independent candidate, the rules for what they need vary so differently from state to state to state. You're like, you need to do what? Are you kidding me? So you're running around the last minute trying to figure out how to tackle some of these.
You need a full-time lawyer or staff of lawyers, it seems to me, to you know, to run this. I mean, I'm just curious, is your, I mean, I recognize, I would imagine you have a very small campaign team, but do you actually have a lawyer responsible for figuring this all out?
We, between our treasurer, between, we've got a lot of smart people, and we hash it out and we make a lot of calls. What did you guys think?
Having a lot of lawyers.
Oh, yeah. We're making a lot of calls to a lot of different state offices saying, what did you mean by this? Could you explain this to us? What form exactly are you talking about? What do you, you know, we're making a lot of calls for clarification. We're on speed dial to a lot of different places saying, okay, what is this? And we're having to learn as we go along. We are a small campaign of, we've got some core, about a dozen core people. Then we've got people transplanted all over that are from all over the country. But the people who hash it out are a small team, and we are just constantly on the phone saying, explain this. How do we get around this? What does this look like in real life? What does this verbiage mean? So we're having to do it the long way because we do have an attorney that was, she just makes sure that what stays in the room, you know, what's said in the room stays in the room, that sort of thing, those sort of confidentiality things. We're prepared for those and prepared for people to not go off and write books on us while we're in, you know, midstream or whatever. So we handled those basic things, but as far as being able to afford those big, huge attorneys, you need a law firm almost. We just rely on really, really smart people and a lot of phone calls.
Sure, I think that you probably get a better result that way anyway. But I guess what I'm trying to reinforce to some extent is, you know, what an amazing achievement it is and what an incredible journey to be able to get yourself on the ballot in as many states as you can, you know, given all these different rules. I mean, I think the average person on the street has something in their head that's sort of like, well, Dr. McRae is running for president. All she does is go out and campaign or something like that. But, you know, nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah, well, for me, nothing can be further from the truth. I actually work and try to do this at the same time. The coronavirus actually has helped me in that way because, just like I said, I do a lot of PTSD evaluations and that sort of thing. I can take my computer with me now or work from home and get a lot of this done in between, you know, podcasts and things like that. And ironically, it's like the universe kind of came to meet me. As bad as this coronavirus is and the deaths and all those things we have to, all the people we have to mourn and grieve for and all the things we have to worry about, at the same rate, none of the candidates can really get around right now. So I don't have the PACs or whatever, but Joe Biden can't run around a campaign. Trump is trying to run around and do his rallies, but he's still going to be getting his same supporters, those diehard supporters nobody knew is going to show up to those rallies. So we're kind of all in the same boat in a really weird, strange way. But I have to work in the midst of this and try to keep my bills paid and still run a campaign. And it's, I think I like it this way a little bit just because I know that in the end, I'm not bought and sold. I like it this way because I, you know, anything worth having is worth working for, so to speak. But people can't accuse me of a lot of things, taking funds or this sort of this thing or the other. No, you know, that's not happening here. So with that being said, I mean, it's
how long do you think? You know, we talked at the beginning of sort of the age of the independent candidate. And now, in the interview that I heard a year ago, your interviewer suggested that Donald Trump was actually an independent candidate. who'd, you know, latched on to the Republicans because of the difficulty of running as an independent. And, you know, for many years, I've advanced the theory that Barack Obama was also an independent candidate who, you know, essentially latched on to the Democratic Party. And I actually see Presidents Trump and Obama as independents, the first of sort of the beginning of what I think could be a string of independent candidates before it's finally recognized as being mainstream. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you, for example, think that Trump really is a Republican?
I think Trump is a Trumplican. I don't think he belongs to any party. I think he's just Trump for Trump. We talked about that earlier about, you know, Obama being independent. I can see how you get to that point. I can see how you're saying that. I think the stronger people, I think strong people come from no parties. I really think that this is a trend. And I think it's not just a trend. I think it's the way things are going to be. I think people are so fed up of the party system that once they break loose, I don't think we're going to be going back to that anytime soon. I think the parties are important, but not when it comes to the when it comes to the extent of just being so locked in place that they can't, you know, they can't see out. And I think people realize that's a mistake.
Well, I think they're clearly a mistake. They're not in the Constitution. I may very well be mistaken on this, but I have some memory trace of, was it George Washington who warned of the dangers of political parties? It was one of the early presidents, in any case, who warned precisely of this type of thing. And, you know, we talked about this earlier, but I'd like to get it into our discussion here to, you know, get your views on this. You know, I think that the parties are clearly toxic, and I think they are preventing a vibrant democracy in America. And I think that an independent revolution is necessary to free people from the chains of the political process. But I also think, and this is what I'd like you to comment on, that a very good start might be so that presidential candidates, make it so the presidential candidates could not be members of political parties. You know, to get this sort of partisanship out of this, out of at least the presidential thing right from the beginning.
I think that that is a perfect world. If we did have that, to not be associated with the party, I think it makes the most sense to get things moving. I just don't know. I would have to really give a lot of thought as how do we get there from here? I think if we let an independent party candidate break through this, Bernie Sanders tried desperately to break through as an independent, and I think he did a lot to chip away at that. But then all he could do in the end was caucus with the Democratic Party. And he's still basically independent. He's still independent, but now he actually it sort of has a Democrat label now since he ran with the Democrats to get out there. He sort of attached to that whole Democratic, the DNC.
Did he sell his soul? Did he sell
his soul? I'm sorry?
Did Bernie Sanders sell his soul by doing that?
I think he felt like that was a necessary thing to do at the time. But the outcome still wound up being the same. In the very end, the Democrats came in and, hey, this is our guy. If he would have just stayed independent, I think he may have done better, actually. I'm not sure what he gained from that. I think it helps me because he left that spot. Because people are still craving that independent candidate. you know, they're still craving a Bernie. I'm not necessarily in alignment with everything Bernie says, but what he stood for as an independent was very important. And people still want that. People want that independent candidate. So when he, you know, caucused with the Democrats, it did kind of leave a lot of people feeling sort of abandoned. And that's unfortunate. But, you know, he left the hole.
So that's would have been better as an independent. Obviously it's hindsight because he did not succeed as a Democrat. But I think I think he would have done better. But one thing that is very interesting here is, you know, so we talk about Bernie Sanders, and Bernie Sanders is not the candidate. But yet, I think that the Bernie Sanders campaign probably has had a much bigger impact on the issues than certainly President Trump or candidate Biden. You would agree?
I would totally agree. Because absolutely, Biden right now is just picking up the talking points of Sanders, or trying to figure out which talking points to pick up, where he can pick up these, you know, the supporters as well. He's moved that needle for healthcare. He's moved that conversation quite a bit. And I don't think we're going to be able to go back to the same conversations because of Bernie. I think he did an excellent job. I'm glad he's been on this earth during this time.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, I don't think the United States is ready for a wealth tax. Yeah, I hope they don't get there, but that's just my view. But
I'm saying go back now to say what now?
Well, talking about Elizabeth Warren and her proposed wealth tax. What I said was I don't think the United States is ready for a wealth tax yet. My personal hope is they don't get there. But I think that this is another example, this whole wealth tax thing, of an issue being moved into the incubation period by somebody who's perceived to be a credible political candidate. And eventually, you know, this thing could be introduced as the Elizabeth Warren wealth tax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words.
Isn't it all about labels, though? You know,
sorry?
It's all about labels. I mean, the tax cuts that were made to the wealthy was very damaging. But trying to get some of the money back, the wording gets to be dangerous. So it's, it can get flipped and turned in all different ways. You know, you really have to go with the economy. You know, I really have to shake that out with the economists to see down the line. The problem is with the tax cuts is that I would have did a tax cut as well, but it would have been to get the economy going, but it would have been attached to really, really clear plans to invest in the United States, not just given willy-nilly for people to go and just buy back their own, you know, stock options or hide money or save it or whatever they're doing. But it wasn't tied to plans. You can't just say, oh, we're going to give these tax cuts to stimulate the economy. You have to think about the mindset of the individual person. Theirs is about, making profits, and that profit might not mean investing back, taking that money and investing in the United States. So, I don't know. It's mostly about languaging, right?
It's largely about that. I can't remember which organization was one of the tax study organizations was trying to understand how to campaign against the estate tax a few years ago. And what they figured out, if I'm understanding this correctly, that the best thing to do would be to call it a death tax. The theory being that estate tax sounds maybe plausible, but death tax somehow sounds abhorrent.
Mm-hmm.
But when you were driving for Lyft, did you ever get into conversations about, taxes and were taxes too high, and or even the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act?
You got to remember that these rides were kind of short. Some of them were short. What I did get into was there was a sense of, as long as my money is good, Trump is fine with me. Don't change thing as long as my money is good. As long as my stock portfolio, it's making a profit, this is about that. If I'm okay, then he's okay with me. That was the gist of most of the conversation. The other people were more, he's got to go, he's lying, he doesn't tell the truth, he twitters all the time, he's embarrassing, all of those things. It was more emotional. And so you had the people that were emotional and people who thought just with their pocket. So those are how those conversations went. But they really didn't get into the tax cuts, so to speak, because people don't know quite what to think about that whole tax cut situation. John, you know what? More currently, right now we have been given like these stimulus package things, people got $1,200 or less. But the bulk of that money has actually went unaccounted for, have went to billionaire corporations. And just recently, it's been going to churches. So the Catholics, for example, got a $1.4 billion bailout or help with a stimulus package. It's just interesting how this has been politicized or being used, to pad the pockets. Of people that, of corporations. It's just a money grab right now. And there is no real way to kind of track this money. People are having to go through hoops. Reporters are trying to track it. There is not a oversight person that is tracking this. Trump fires everyone who might actually track the money trail. So it's just really interesting how this money is being spent, billions and billions of dollars that aren't necessarily going towards the people to keep the economy going. So,
right. Well, a couple of thoughts I have on that. One is that this whole coronavirus relief has been administered through the tax system, through the U.S. tax system, which is very problematic because there's all kinds of U.S. residents, low-income people, what have you, who are not in the tax system and can't understand, how to access that kind of money. But I'll tell you what else is really interesting, and I have firsthand experience with this, is that I know of U.S. citizens living outside the United States, okay, who have received this money and who are getting, equivalent benefits in their country of residence. And I think that most U.S. residents would find that objectionable, but I also know of people who have renounced U.S. citizenship, living outside the United States, who have received this. And I have read anecdotally, I don't know any dead people, but I have read anecdotally that there are a large number of deceased people who have received this thing. And, I think sort of underpins my theory that to do this automatically through the tax apparatus is just madness.
Right. Right. It wasn't. And the thing about it is that there's a lot written that suggests, from the Obama administration and even before that they knew a pandemic was going to hit the United States eventually. And how unprepared they were to make sure that the basic things are in place, food, water, and shelter for people. you know, hospitals and the equipment to make sure that those things are in place. That didn't happen. And so everything was sort of a weird, like we're going to throw money at it. And throwing money at it seemed more to sort of keep the masses calm, but not necessarily thinking about the long-term effects or how to keep it going to where it makes sense. This sort of just throw this at it. Okay, we'll wait a few months, see if everybody gets upset, and see if anybody's suffering. Okay, all right, the masses are getting upset. They're getting antsy. Okay, let's throw some money at it to kind of quiet them down. That's what it feels like to me. It feels like let's just throw money at it to calm people down, not necessarily strategically. How will this affect people going forward? And I think that it feels like they're throwing money down to the masses so that they can take the big money and run with it. Like, let me throw a little pennies over here while you guys are down on the ground picking up these pennies. Let us, you know, drive off with the suitcases full of cash. That's what it feels like to me, more than anything. And unfortunately, the taxpayers are paying for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, I think the coronavirus thing is likely to have an impact on this election. It's clearly had a huge impact in a good way for you, and that people can't go around and campaign, really. So it's sort of, leveled the playing field in the sense that you can't be outspent, at least in terms of personal appearances.
Now, let me clarify. I have lost family members with this coronavirus. So when I say that it's working, just only in one aspect of my life, it's easing that pain. It's not when it comes to the actual grief and loss issues and the people we've had. Because I'm African American, our death rate and our serious illness rate is a lot higher. So where I can understand where in these rural areas they just have no clue and feel like they don't need to wear a mask. But for us here in my community, I just lost an uncle 2-3 days ago. My aunt was able to come home. We've lost, so many people. One of my staff lost her mom. I mean, it's very close to us. It's very close to us. So we know people, all of us know people personally that have actually caught the virus and have almost died from the virus, which is interesting, which is sad, which means that we're a lot more paranoid. We're a lot more worried about what's going to happen next. So that doesn't work for me. But what does work is that it sort of made the world stop for a minute to let me catch up a little bit with this campaign, because everybody had to stop for a minute. So that works coronavirus-wise. But other than that, no. This is like the most terrible thing that could be happening right now, because it's wiping out hundreds of thousands of people. And around the world, this is a great problem. You know, Brazil, I have family members in Brazil, and so we can't exactly go see them. They can't come here. So they're the second hardest hit. So a lot of this is very close to home for me as well. So.
I'm sorry to hear that it's touched you so personally and so close.
Yeah, it's real, folks. Yeah, it's real.
No, it's just real. It's just more real.
It's
more real to some than others.
Yes, it's more real to some than others. The trick is, the hope is that it doesn't have to be real to everybody. And,
right.
I don't want it to spread to all these different areas of the country. It's starting to hit, though. And I don't think Trump's rallies are helping at all.
No.
So, yeah. There I have a real big problem with his lack of leadership there. All he really had to do, 3 months ago, was to say, hey, guys, we need your cooperation. Stay home, wear a mask,
let's get through this. We could have been just like China and everybody else right now, just out free and, you know, with some concerns, but not going backwards the way we are right now in the United States. So I'm very upset about that. Yeah, hopefully the voters will reflect that as well. So we'll see.
Well, may I ask you, I mean, what do you think? I mean, let's say that you were able to decree the Dr. McCrae response to this immediately and it would go into effect immediately. What do you think the best response to the coronavirus thing can or should be in the United States at the present time?
At the present time, I think right now we just need to take up an inventory of exactly what's going on. Let's shelter in place for just a, let's just see where we're at. Right now, we have the media kind of shifted where now you don't hear so much about it on certain channels. But for some states, I mean, some cities are being hit hard. And we have to respect their wishes as far as shutting down. Some cities just have to really just shut down and, like, let's stay in place. Our governor, the governor of New York, he feels like our governor feels like the governor for the United States. It's like you can't put money before the people because ultimately it's going to affect the money anyway. What I would have done is shut it down a long time ago and just shelter in place for 6 weeks, made sure people had food, water, those things that they need while we figured this thing out. Now we're at a position now, it's like going backwards. It's going to be very difficult to get people to go backwards and shelter in place now that they've gotten loose and now it's summertime. I think we'd have to do it city by city, you know, state by state, city by city. The best possible thing to do would be to just shut every damn thing down for a minute and do what we should have done back in February, March, and get it over with. It's like, let's just get this flu over with. I remember when we were kids, like if one kid had chicken pox, they would just bring over all the kids. Let's just get all these this chicken pox over with at once. You know, let's expose all the kids at once. Let's just get it over with and move on. Chicken pox parties.
Right.
In some ways, it makes sense to just shut it down. Let's see what this is about. You know, because you've got to be able to jump from one person to the next. Definitely mask wherever you go out. That's what's keeping it at a bay, you know, at a decent level here in Indiana. We're not shooting up crazy, but we're also not crowding into restaurants right now either. Restaurants are scarcely open. They're open, but when you go in, you know, people are spaced very, very far apart or outside. So the restaurants here are either not open yet, or if they are open, they're very, very, everyone's in mask and their tables are separated. So they're trying to adhere to that. And we're sort of staying level here in Indiana. We would have to at least adhere to the original CDC rules. CDC is sort of lifting their rules a bit. Like, for example, they're talking about letting the kids go back to school. So Trump is saying rewrite the rules so that it is not so difficult. I think we have to rely on science with this and say, okay, what do we need to do to get out of this? Pull our scientists together and say, what do we need to do to get out of this? In China, whether it started there or not, they are doing the best job at getting this thing handled. We have to follow the lead of someone else who's doing it better.
Well, one thing that I think unifies all of your comments on this is the need for clear leadership. Agreed?
Absolutely.
Yeah, which I you know, one can debate whether we've had that in the United States or not. I hate to move from one tragedy to another, but since we apparently have moved into the part of our discussion where we're talking about tragedies. Socially, the last few months have been tremendously difficult in the United States. You know, the issues with the police and that sort of stuff. Would you be willing to share any of your thoughts with respect to those issues?
Oh, I think what you've been seeing, the George Floyd situation, keep in mind that African-American people here in the United States are sharing those type of videos almost every week. Every week we see, across my social media, there's someone getting shot while they're trying to run away. There's some kid or something. We get this stuff constantly, so it's hitting us constantly. The George Floyd thing, I think, hit everybody hard because it was 8 minutes and 46 seconds of watching someone be murdered. For me, I was already in sort of a place of, I've got to do something about this. So for me, I was already in motion. I'm running for president. I've got to do something about this. I've got to do something about what's going on here in the United States, the disparities of justice and all of these things. I think that it's interesting all of a sudden watching the world kind of get it. This is not normal. This is not what it's supposed to be. African-American people, I will tell you, most of us know that this was how it has been. What we were surprised about, what has surprised the African-American people, is not that these things are going on. We knew they were going on. What has surprised American people is that even with video cameras showing that this is going on, that these police officers are walking away scot-free. Even with the video footage, it is still going on and nothing is happening. That's what's the word is that's the problem that the African Americans are feeling. Here is the evidence. You can't tell us anymore that you don't know this is going on, and it's still going on. It's no surprise it is going on for us. It's just that the surprise is you've got evidence in your face, and with qualified immunity, you let these guys off, and that's what we're upset about. So
where do you see this going? Part of me feels as though, the whole United States of America is about to embark on some kind of a civil war with all this type of stuff going on. But I mean, what do you think is necessary to begin to turn the page on this shameful continuation of a long chapter of American history?
Well, as far as police departments are concerned, I've talked to a lot of police folk, and a lot of them are military guys that turn police officers. So I talk to those guys a lot and say, hey, what's going on here, and what are you proposing? And a lot of the police officers and police departments are saying, that guy needs to be prosecuted to the fullest extent. There needs to just be more conversation, and people have to come right out and say what's right is right and what's wrong is wrong, so we can get all on the same page. Globally, this has caught the eye of people globally as well. So this was resonating across our world as far as people being targeted for one reason or the next and thought to be less than, enough to be less than that you can abuse them for no other reason than their religion or their color. And I think a lot of people around the world is feeling that. So I'm thinking there's just going to be a shift. You wouldn't think that one man's death would shift people that much. But there was the other deaths as well that's really resonating with people. The young man, last name is McLean, the violinist, he's resonating with people because so many things were being hidden and they're coming out now. So I don't know if you can put the lid back on this. I'm really thankful that these things are becoming to be more in the open. The problem is that with any movement, positive movement, there's always this, these anarchists that go in behind those people that mean well and try to make things difficult. And that's what's happened here as well.
Right. Well, I thank you for that. Probably we should be moving towards the end here. And it's sort of an interesting way to end this. Could you share some thoughts with me about just the day-to-day logistics of running as an independent candidate for president of the United States?
I'm sorry, what was your question again?
What's it like?
It is a roller coaster on a day-to-day basis, and it's exhilarating at times, but much more frustrating, especially as an independent candidate and the push to be quiet. There's that belief that people, it's like people do have the belief, if you're running independent, that means that you're running for the opposite candidate. So by you running, you are taking votes away from this party, so you're for this party. And so that's, you're pushing against that while you're trying to give people an option besides those two candidates. You're trying to give them an option, but at the same rate, you could be seen either way. And then from state to state, the rules are different. So for us, it's, okay, what does North Carolina want? What does this place want? So it's a lot of shuffling of paperwork, getting signatures, running to state houses, you know, trying to make sure we get our stuff in. Fundraising, we've pretty much given up on that. We know that we are the underdog candidate. And it's like when we get there, it'll be there. But It's exhilarating. It's fun. It's frustrating. It's heart-wrenching. It's a lot of work and a lot of sleepless nights, but it's worth it. It's worth it to stay in the race. It's worth it to believe, to keep your belief that you can change things. And we're going to change some things. And together, you know, we're going to all do this. We're going to get this where it's going. And an independent candidate is the purest way to do that. It's not being on either side. It's being for the people. I can't iterate that enough. It's really being for the people, not for the parties.
By definition. And I think that you are a fantastic candidate. I really do. And I'm not going to wish you success so much as I'm going to wish you the energy, the focus, the organization, and the determination to keep up what you're doing.
Thank you.
And I also, you need somebody in your campaign who's going to write the book. Dr. Valerie McCrae for president. Sort of the rebranding of the independent movement or something like that, which is where I think you've got to see this.
Yes. I'm looking forward to this. I was glad to know that there, when I jumped out as independent, I didn't know that there were such great organizations out there for independents to promote the independent parties. And so I'm just so glad to know that I'm not alone in my independence. So,
you're not alone, but I could imagine you have lonely days.
Oh, gosh, you would not believe it. You definitely have lonely days. There are days.
And there are days. But the important thing is this, there's going to be an election. We know that win, lose, or draw, the very fact of running and participating in debate is an unbelievably important contribution to the democratic process. God knows the United States of America needs that at this particular moment, and I think that you are ideally positioned to contribute to that process. So I congratulate you. I thank you as a concerned individual and wish you all those things I said a minute ago. But you know what? I think it's important for people to be able to connect with you online and that. So Dr. Valerie McCray, could I invite you to take a moment and give everybody your coordinates? How can they get in touch with you, follow your exciting progress, all that good stuff?
Hey, you know what? The best way to reach me is McCray2020.com. You can write right into that website. There's also Dr. Valerie at McCray2020.com. And those emails, I actually still respond to my own emails one at a time. So if you write to me, it will be me that's responding back. I'm still small enough to do that. I'm not that so busy that I can't do that. I don't have much sleep, but I still do that.
You're still carrying on your full-time job while you're doing this.
I'm still carrying on a full-time job while I'm doing that.
I think that would be a central part of your campaign. Anybody who can both run for president and keep a full-time job clearly has the ability to manage things, yes?
I you know what? I think so. I absolutely think so, especially my job as a I do PTSD evaluations for veterans right now. So being able to stay in those two worlds, meld those two worlds, it's quite a juggling act, but we're able to do it. And I'm excited about the possibility of being president of the United States. I think we can actually do this, John. I don't know why I have this belief, but I just believe we can actually do it.
You told me earlier that you lived for a period of time in Detroit, and Detroit was, as you know, I think the home of Henry Ford, a Ford automobile company. And, he repeatedly made a very simple statement, which was this, whether you think you can do something or you can't do something, you're right either way. Keep that vision going. So once again, this would be McCray2020.com. And I want to emphasize that is two C's, McCray2020.com. All right. Well, the chat here, and I'm very excited to pick up another one with you at some point. Is there anything else you'd like to say by way of anything? A call to vote?
No.
A vote for Dr. McCray.
Definitely called to vote. Look for me on the ballot. Write me in on the ballots that we can't get in. But we are definitely at least going to be a write-in candidate for every state on the ballot for as many states as we can. We can hit all those marks, but there's no reason why you won't be able to vote for me in 2020. So I'm excited about that. Please do that. And register right now to vote. Make sure you're registered so that won't be an issue. There's a lot of things being thrown in people's way, so we got to make sure we jump over those hurdles and make sure that they check to make sure they're registered and make sure that they're registered if they're not. So just keep a positive attitude and let's just move forward and see what happens and lock arms and we got this.
All right.
All righty.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. McCray.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Very welcome.
All right. Thanks.